Following our theme from Philippians of the self-emptying, we're now going to look at self-emptying in nature, particularly before the coming of human beings. Genesis chapter 1. God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kind, cattle, reptiles, and wild animals, all according to their kind." Then God said, "Let us make man in our image and likeness, to rule the fish of the sea, the birds of heaven, the cattle, all wild animals on earth, and all reptiles that crawl upon the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful and increase, fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of heaven, and every living thing that moves upon the earth." God also said, "I give you all plants that bear seed everywhere on earth, and every tree bearing fruit which yields seed. They shall be yours for food. All green plants I give for food to the wild animals, to all the birds of heaven, and to all reptiles on earth. Every living creature." So it was, and God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. Evening came, and morning came, a sixth day. There's a famous painting of Holman Hunt's of Jesus as the light of the world, pictured holding a lantern in one hand and knocking on the door of your heart with the other. But I have a more favourite one. It's Jesus in the carpenter shop as a young man, same artist. He's in the carpenter shop before embarking on his 3-year mission. He's full of carefree joy, and with hands above his head he's dancing. But, unknown to him, the light source in the carpenter shop has cast a shadow behind him onto the wall. The superimposition of Jesus' dancing shadow onto one cast by 2 pieces of wood depicts his crucifixion. The shadow cast over his carefree dancing is yet but a shadow. It's not yet a reality. It lurks ahead in the future. In other words, the implications of the crucifixion already cast their challenge over the history of the world prior to its realization. Can we find in nature a foretaste of the cross and the self-emptying implicit in it? Is there a kenosis, a self-emptying, in nature before and after the advent of Homo sapiens? Richard Dawkins and the ultra-Darwinists speak of selfish genes and the selfish struggle for survival, which underlies the theory of evolution. I wonder if the shadow of the cross in the background might instead throw a different light upon it. Could there in fact be a self-sacrifice, something altruistic instead of or alongside the notion of selfishness in nature? To be honest, neither the word selfish nor the word altruistic are really appropriate to pre-primate animals. As the philosopher Alfred North Whitehead pointed out in his distinction of categories, selfish and altruistic are projections of human ethical values onto pre-human nature. That nature has neither selfish intent nor the self-conscious moral choice to be altruistic. However, the shadow of the cross's self-sacrifice might be discerned. Life, coded by the genes, is always encapsulated in a particular body and a particular individual. This individual organism defends itself. Without this self-preservation, the genetic code could be lost. A particular individual has some good attributes of its species, but it does not have all the good attributes of its species. These are distributed in the species itself. Rather like Lavant football team. Some are good at defending, some at attacking, some at heading, some at kicking. Soon we begin to see that the team, Lavant Football Club, contains the collection of good attributes of its individuals. So the species contains the amalgam of the good attributes of its individual members. Now we see that survival and adaption to new environments has a greater chance of success in the maintenance of the species rather than of the individual. The genes survive in the species identity more than in the individual identity, although they can only manifest themselves in nature through the individual. The individual who must die to pass on the genetic code to the next generation, to enable it to adapt to be fit for the changing environmental conditions, can be seen to sacrifice itself for the species. We can't go into similar detail through every step, but we would, if we did, recognize several facts. Only those organisms survive that find a fitness in an ecosystem. The genes of an individual of the species become dependent on the genes in many other species which are in their ecosystem. Animals have no genes for photosynthesis, but such genes in plants are vital to them. Ungulates, like a cow, cannot digest cellulose without the bacteria in their rumen. Survival of the fittest is not something a gene or even an organism has as such. Adaptation, the central word in Darwinian theory, is an ecological word, not a genetic one. That the myriad creatures are in contest and competition cannot be denied. Nor can it be denied that they are bonded together in interdependencies. Seen in this more comprehensive scheme of things, plants function for survival of myriads of others. We could even say, provocatively perhaps, for our kenosis approach, that they are emptied into, given over to, devoted to, or sacrificed for others in their community. When I play chess, it can't be said that the queen sacrifices herself for a winning breakthrough. She's only a piece of wood, that's Alfred North Whitehead's point. But it can be said that within the rules that set up the chess game, I sacrifice the queen for her side to win. God orders, not the rule, well, he does order the rules of chess, but also the rules of creation. The sacrificial element is supplied by him using the construction of nature. Nature can be said to be acting in a self-emptying, self-sacrificing way, which is, of course, still pre-moral. Each of the struggling creatures is delivered over to preserve a line. In flesh and blood creatures, each is a blood sacrifice, perishing that others may live. We have a kind of slaughter of the innocents, a non-moral, naturalistic harbinger of the slaughter of Rachel's children at Ramah, at the birth of Christ. All are perhaps vignettes, hinting at the innocent lamb slain from the foundation of the world. They foreshadow as they participate in the divine pathos. They share the labor of the divinity. Long before humans arrive on the scene, nature was already a via dolorosa. In this sense, like in Hunt's carpenter shop painting, the aura of the cross is cast backwards across the whole global story, and it forever outlines our future. If so, kenosis, so far from being in stark contrast to selfish genes, might be an integral part of the evolutionary drama. The amoral flora and fauna are locked in their ecosystems. But human species are not. We are unique in not being trapped in one particular ecosystem. We can, as Genesis expresses it, dominate it, having power over it. But we have been appointed stewards of nature. Nature's self-emptying is non-moral. We have choice and moral knowledge and sensibility. We are the gate from biology to ethics and from ethics to spirituality. So we reach the possibility of kenosis in the classical Christian sense, where a self-interested individual limits themselves on behalf of others deliberately. The Christian opportunity today is to limit our human aggrandizement of reducing all nature to a human resource by sacrificing such a desire in favor of the 5 million other species who also reside on Earth. In doing so, we will refine the stewardship of Adam and fall under the life-giving shadow of Hunt's cross.